Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to NITP's For Your Benefit. We're here this Monday morning, January 27th, 2014. And what we're going to do today, we're going to walk through a federal career, starting at the beginning, mid, and pre-retirement, maybe even post-retirement. And we'll talk about why did you come to the federal government? Why did you stay? What should you look for early on that many people don't? Mid-career, what decisions should you be looking at? And pre-retirement, what should you be looking at? And to lead us in that discussion is Bob Braunstein. Bob is a retired Fed fellow seminar presenter, knows the benefits up, down, and sideways. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Well, good that you're on the phone if we're going to talk about benefits, this should be fun. So since you've been there, done it, and I've been there, didn't do it, that was there a little bit, but in the federal sector, but as a young person, what drove you to want to go to the federal government?
Interesting question. You know, I was an Army brat, and my folks settled in the Washington area. And I wound up going to school locally. I went to Georgetown University. And when I took my first summer job, since I was in grad school at night, as it happens, I went to work for the Internal Revenue Service for what was then known as the Personnel Division. I was working for the technical advisor to the HR director, then known as the chief of personnel. Spent about 3 or 4 months doing that and decided that it really made sense to probably continue with the career. I really liked what I was doing. I was a history major, but I was a public administration master's program person. So I decided to just stay in the government. After all, I was getting a lot of advice from my folks that this was a great career. There was a lot of security. And back in 1970, which this is what we're talking about, when I was looking at my first federal job, that was really the life for folks who were in D.C. I mean, there were not a large number of contractors. Beltway bandits, per se, did not exist. And you went to work for the federal government. It was kind of a thought of as a womb-to-tomb type of thing. I mean, it was the environment was not complex from a benefit standpoint. My primary goal back then was, all right, let's get a good job. Working for the government's a great job. Both my folks were civil servants. And look for a good benefits package in the employer that I'm seeking. And, of course, when you worked for the government, it didn't matter which agency you worked for. The benefits package was essentially the same. That was my thought process at the time.
Okay. Now, entering federal service, looking backwards, what would you have done then that you didn't know to do but you know now?
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, the landscape now, Bob, as you and I both know, is much more complex than it was, you know, 40-plus years ago. Back then, when you came to work, you know, you signed up for health insurance, which is an important thing to do. Life insurance, I didn't really need that much. I mean, my parents were my beneficiaries for quite a few years because I wasn't married or anything like that. And there was what's known as a defined benefit program, which still exists. That's the annuity under the old CSRS program, into which every 2 weeks, whether you wanted it or not, 7% of your gross pay was placed into the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund. That was your contribution. You really didn't have anything to think about. It was very, I guess, what you'd call paternalistic. The government took care of you. You contributed. The only thing I could think of that I might have done differently, looking back on it and looking at the relative value of it now, CSRS folks, think about this, is voluntary contributions. Because I could have been making voluntary contributions earlier on, and that might have eventually given me a larger annuity value, or it could have given me this rare opportunity to perhaps put money into a Roth, which, as you know, doesn't have Roth IRAs don't have minimum required distributions, and in most cases, they're not taxed when you draw them down. That's probably what that's the only thing I could think of that back then would have been available to me that I did not do.
Okay, and now in today's world, a young Fed just joining federal service, they might have some bills to be paid outside. So you and I can sit here and say, do this, do that, do this, do that. But as you mentioned, the Roth, and they have a Roth TSP, which you can put an awful lot of money into if you can afford the cash flow. But somebody very young putting money into that will then have it accrue, grow 20, 25, 30, 35 years, and it'll grow into something that'll be tax-free. Now, not in concept, in reality, if you put a dollar into the TSP, whether it's the traditional TSP or the Roth TSP, and you make your election, at the end of that period of time, it's going to grow to the exact same amount. There will be not a penny's worth of difference if you put them side by side. The difference is, at the beginning, there was no tax benefit allowed to the individual that went to the Roth TSP, but there would be if they went to the traditional. Now, most likely, somebody at the beginning stage of their career isn't making what they're going to make later on. So why not put it in then if you can afford it? Because, again, it's going to grow to the exact same amount. The difference is, when it comes out, there's no tax. Why? Because it was taxed when it went in, but it was taxed at a low rate, under the assumption that the beginning Fed salary is going to be less than what it's going to be mid-career and certainly pre-retirement. That makes sense?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I remember when TSP was launched, when FERS became for new retirees, for new federal employees, about 1987. And the CSRS people were actually allowed to participate, albeit at a much lower rate of percentage of salary, 5% as opposed to the 10% that the FERS folks were able to do. And now those percentage limitations have essentially gone away. You know, I constantly counsel new folks coming in when we teach the newer classes that what you probably want to do as quickly as you can is get to at least the point where you get the full match from the government. As you know, the government gives FERS employees 1% automatically in TSP, and then if they contribute 5% of income, they get a dollar for dollar match on the next on the first 3%, 50 cents on the dollar for the next 2%. And irrespective, and this I learned from you, of whether they contribute to a Roth side of an account or a tax-deferred side, the matching money from the government always goes to the tax-deferred side. And they're vested in those contributions from the government once they've served 3 years. I tell people, get to that level as soon as you can, because even if you leave the government, you'll always have that TSP account. You can always roll qualified funds into it, tax-deferred funds from IRAs, 401k plans, 403b, and not to mention the fact that during difficult times, you always have that G fund, which has typically outperformed money market and some of these other certificates of deposit. So it's always a great way to go. I think it's a great idea. It's definitely something that should always be on the radar of new employees of today, for sure, which unfortunately wasn't available to us in CSRS and never was in full measure, even if we did join.
Right. And we have a fan of the show that emails us, and he asked us what we were going to do this Monday, and he emailed us back with several comments to be made. One was very good. We're talking about the beginning career individual, that they need to educate themselves on what the market is, the importance of investing, because their retirement, while guaranteed, isn't as large as a CSRSer. It's no small potatoes. It's nice, but probably isn't going to be enough in and of itself to carry one through retirement. So really, the FERS folks, and I call it the triple-decker sandwich, they have the annuity, they have Social Security, and they have what they have in the thrift. And that can be a very substantial amount if started at the beginning of the career. And they need to understand that, and they need to understand the difference between the different stock funds and the G fund and what a bond fund is. So financial literacy is key, and it's not so easy always to get. Of course, if they listen to the show, we do financial literacy shows, and we do financial literacy short seminars, and probably more so coming webinars. This is not a plug for the company. It's just, it's just you know, where do you get the information? TSP website's terrific. Some of the daily publications you can get online are terrific. But you have to go out and get it because it's not necessarily intuitive, and it's not everybody isn't created equal as far as being able to understand it. And don't follow the water cooler advice, as they say.
Well, you know, you raise a good point. Let me turn the tables on you a little bit. You know, I know that you studied accounting when you were in college and ultimately became certified as a CPA. And a lot of high-level financial training. And I'm curious, you know, you were out there looking for a job. I mean, how important to you, given your knowledge of the field, certainly from a tax and finance perspective, what were the things you attached weight to when you were looking at prospective employers?
I'm going to give you a very frank answer.
Okay.
Money. It's true. My who was, you know, I always look up to him. He's probably was my best friend while he was alive. And he said, son, benefits to dad, dollars. Because at that time, to get into the federal government, you had to fill out that massive 171 form and then wait for a fairly long time to get, if you were lucky, to get hired. I graduated from school in 69, 70, and jobs were not plentiful, somewhat like back in 2008 and 9. And so I could go into the federal government, but I could make twice as much, oddly enough, preparing tax returns and no benefits. The place I worked in, you sometimes feared for eating lunch, but it was fun. And I was around a lot of young people like myself, and it was good money. Now, in retrospect, I maybe shouldn't have been so anxious to make the money. I should have been anxious to say, what am I going to do for the rest of my life as far as creating a pot of money someplace to retire on and or an annuity? There was no annuity in this company. There was stock in a company that I think when I left, was if it was worth a penny a share, it was worth a lot. So there wasn't a lot there. But to be frank, it was all about dollars.
Got it. Well, so in other words, benefits was not high on your radar.
No.
It's funny. We came from different environments, and you know, my folks were very, very much into benefits. My dad was retired military, became a retired Fed, as did my mom. So that was definitely something for me to think about. But you know, when I came on board, they throw a lot of information at you, and I think this is true for most employees. Many folks are interested in getting on board, getting their first paycheck, probably getting their health insurance. Signing up for things like life insurance, which may not even be high on their radar if they aren't married or if they, you know, don't really have that many beneficiaries. But it's there's certain rules of thumb. You know, I always tell folks what you want to do is balance what you intend to put away for retirement against what you need to live on now. It's a matter of, well, if I'm maxing out the TSP, but I'm early in my career, then I'm having to spend a lot of my discretionary income to do that, and that's probably not what most financial planners would recommend. You want to gradually increase that as you can afford to do it, but you still have to live today, and the future is uncertain. It's hard to know. One of the major questions that I get, again, this is kind of a tax question. As a new employee, what should you do to be certain you're having enough withheld from your pay? For tax purposes, given all of the other things that are being pulled, how can you be sure that you're having enough withheld for taxes? And is it a good idea to say over withhold so you can get that refund every year? I get this question a lot, and I'm not sure I really know the answer.
Okay, I'll give you a financial literacy answer and a realistic answer. It's very hard when somebody hands you this W-4 form, and this could be pre-retirement as well as beginning, and say, pick the number of exemptions. Well, immediately, exemption sounds like a body, a person. And it's really got nothing to do with that. It's an exemption from withholding. So the fewer you claim, the more they're going to withhold. The more you claim, the less they're going to withhold. But still, it's somewhat of a ping-pong match initially. And the best way to do it, and today's beginning career Fed is much more computerate than certainly I was, maybe you, if they do their tax returns on a computer-aided software product, they can pretend that they received X dollars in salary, and they'll know what needs to be withheld, so they could back into it that way and say, gee, if I claim a certain number of exemptions and I need $200 a month, $500 a month withheld from my compensation, that's where I'm going. Then at the end of the year, I've covered my flanks. I've put in enough so that I either get a small refund or a small balance due. Now, in pure economic theory, it's better to owe than it is to get a refund. Why? Because you're using somebody else's money. If you owe them too much, there's a small penalty because of that. But later on, when somebody becomes more financially astute, they might look at it that way. A large refund, I think, is emotionally nice. Gee, I'll take it and I'll do XYZ with it. Well, if you could have put that same money away and put more money into the TSP, or try to save it and invest it on your own, or create a small pot of money and just in case fund, I think it's better to utilize those dollars for that reason than to get a large refund. And, everybody say, how much is your refund? Well, I don't know that the people that got a large refund should be bragging. Because they missed the the economic opportunity cost that just went to zero.
I like that comment you just made about just in case funds. I think back about what I didn't do properly. This makes me reflect upon it. Debt management. It's easy to get into credit card hock, particularly as a new employee. I mean, you finally have income, you have credit cards, you're getting rushed by some companies to sign up for their cards, and the next thing you know, you start maxing these things out, and when you look at those minimum payments, to pay off at the rate of minimum payments, even though that's legally okay, it could take you years, and you're paying tons and tons of interest. I wished that I had had information on a good debt management strategy. I mean, in other words, what should my income to debt ratio be? And as a new employee, and how should I continue to manage that as I go? I'm sure you get these questions. You're a financial and a tax guy. I mean, are there any rules of thumb associated to how I could have perhaps managed my debt better? And at this point in time, what do you recommend to folks just starting out?
Actually, this is going to be a twofold answer. One, I'm going to get a credit card only because it will generate my credit worthiness. I'm not getting it so that I can delay paying the payments and then delay paying the payments after that, because the interest rate on most cards is pretty steep. Some would argue, you get mileages or you get refunds back. It'll never be as much as you're paying. So I would get it to establish my credit. I'm not answering your question. I'm getting to it, though. Then I don't know that we're going to be buying a place right away, but, again, let's say beginning career could be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. I might be looking at getting a mortgage, and this will establish my credit worthiness along with paying my bills on time, my utility bills, etc. Now, when I get to the mortgage, if you're looking at a mortgage and it's half of your bring home pay, that's rough. So the dollar magnitude, I don't think, is as much a focus as is the cash flow magnitude. In other words, can I pay my credit cards off every month? Can I handle a mortgage of $300,000, $400,000? That's a lot of money. With today's low interest rates, it's a little bit masked over what it was years ago. I'm not geezing with this. It's just sometimes somebody will say, gee, it went from 3 to 4%. Well, still pretty low. But you got to look at your cash flow, because you don't want to be mortgage poor and credit card poor. You might have a nice place with lawn furniture to sit on, and then you're worried about eating. Where can I cut on my groceries? So it's really a cash flow than a dollar amount.
How much discretionary income do you think, as a percentage of take-home pay, should a person look to have? I mean, obviously, a mortgage is going to be expensive, but what should you... In other words, if you're, say, bringing home $1,000 every 2 weeks, I mean, how much of that should be discretionary, in your opinion?
No, I'm probably going to, I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble with this, but I'd say $250.
So, in other words, the rest of it's outflow.
Oh, no, outflow, groceries, lunches, occasional good time. Life insurance, maybe don't need a ton then, but I ought to get in the habit of getting it, because the younger I get it, the cheaper I get it. My necessities. So if I have $500 a month left for non-necessity things that will come up, car might need a repair. I might have an expense that I might not have otherwise. At the holiday time, I'm probably going to spend more money than what I do. In the non-holiday time, occasionally there's a birthday. Again, the younger I am, the more weddings I'm going to be going to. So I don't want to go into hock for those discretionaries that are really mandatory.
Right. Right, because you definitely want to have money set aside for that. Well, then this gets back to the whole idea of what you were talking about before, exemptions, sometimes called allowances. I mean, one of the things that I did, whether it was right or wrong, and you can comment on this, is that, you know, as I, you know, moved along in my career, got married, had kids, got a mortgage, I found that I was able to better manage those expenses by increasing my cash flow, which means I claimed more allowances or exemptions. And that gave me more money in order to cover the mandatory things I absolutely had to, as well as it gave me money for, you know, parties and weddings and going out and things like that, the things that, like you say, are mandatory but are essentially discretionary. I've asked you this question before, and I know it's a question of balance, but, you know, how many allowances is one safe to claim, you know, in order to essentially cash flow what we call, I guess you call, increasing outflow associated with mortgage, expenses for kids, et cetera?
I'm going to give you an evasive answer. It depends. All righty. So what does it depend on? Well, some of those mandatory expenses we may have would include a mortgage. Well, the mortgage will certainly include interest. You're going to have some real estate taxes, and you're going to have some principal. The real estate taxes and the interest are going to be tax deductible, which would lower your income subject to income tax. So I could maybe go up a notch or two, one or two more than what I was prior to buying that, because it helps me afford it. I mean, it's kind of crazy not to do that just to get a refund at the end of the year. You might as well use it to help pay the mortgage. So I don't know if there's a magic number, because we have people that are single, we have people that are married, we have people that have other issues. So if I say, well, it should be two or three, we're going to get some calls say you're wrong. And in that case, it probably would be. So again, I think I get back to, I test that tax return out if I'm using a computer-aided software product, or if I have somebody prepare my return, then I'm going to say, give me a projection of what I need to have withheld. I do an awful lot of that. People changing jobs mid-career, people retiring, you know, what should I do? So it's a good question, but it doesn't have a pat answer. Sorry.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because I hear you saying this, and I've learned so much in the latter part of my career. I wish I'd had somebody like you to go to. You know, I know federal employees have a pretty, I guess it was a pretty well-defined package of benefits, and agencies are becoming more and more astute with respect to financial literacy early. I see more and more younger folks coming to our classes, and we actually have structured NITP retirement seminars around the newer people. But one of the things that I continue to say, particularly when I talk to, you know, private clients, and I have a few of those, is that, you know, I'm a benefits guy, and I can help you understand the value of your benefits, your defined benefit, your FERS benefit, what that's going to be, your Social Security benefit, which is time spent in the government as well as time spent in other areas where you were paying that payroll tax, the FICA tax, and, of course, the value of TSP, which, you know, as you mentioned before very aptly, if that's a good, robust amount when you're ready to retire, then I really think you could probably do better than the CSRSers. But I recommend to a lot of folks along the way that one of the best ways to get a handle on what it is you're doing for planning purposes, goal setting, et cetera, is to hook up with somebody who understands finance and understands it within the federal arena, somebody like you. What are your thoughts on that? How soon should somebody start aligning themselves with an astute financial planner, somebody who truly understands their world, what they're doing, what they're planning to do in their careers?
All right. The answer is probably if there's a fee associated with it, there might be some pushback. So if I was a beginning career Fed, I would take every course they offered. I might even go to adult education night courses. It's surprising to me at the people we meet at the pre-retirement and the mid-career that really don't have a handle on what it's going to take to march them through to retirement and then beyond. I won't say they don't have a clue. They have an idea. But how many times have we heard in the last few years, forget the market crash and the like, I have to work another few years because I don't have enough to retire on. And these are feds. These people might have a CSRS annuity. They might have a FERS annuity. But they weren't aware to do this earlier on. So grab anything you can for financial literacy. You can actually go online and you know, if you have a question, we talked about what we were going to talk about. Probate. What's probate? Well, go online, probate. And it's actually a lot less scary when reading it online than it is trying to ask somebody that might answer you in multisyllable words.
Probate. That's one of the questions that I was thinking about asking you, too. I mean, a lot of people, and again, they ask me, and I'm not really the person to talk to. I'm a benefits guy. They say, all right, you know, I've got these designations of beneficiary forms that I'm filling out. And you know, I can change them, and they help me, you know, do something different than what the legal order of precedence would be. If I were to die, my life insurance legal order of precedence would go to my spouse first, my kids next, parents, a will next of kin. But if I wanted to deviate from that order, you know, I fill out these designations of beneficiary forms for TSP, life insurance, and I change those along the way. I mean, my life circumstances change. I may get married again as I have children. But one of the things that people, I think, confuse those with are, you know, what you would put into a will, because it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that a will, actually, even in the legal order of precedence, is number four. And a will in no way trumps what you have on the designation of beneficiary form. I mean, that stands alone. But a will does a lot of really great things with respect to where your estate's going to go and so on and so forth. And the question I get is, you know, is it a good thing to have one? And how soon should I get it? And should I do it on my own? Should I see, you know, somebody who really understands how to draw up a will, in other words, go to a professional service to have it done. What's your take on wills, and okay, when should people start thinking about getting involved?
So we're moving away from the beginning career, heading towards mid-career, maybe are in mid-career at this point, and don't think you should wait till then to have a will. But if you do have life insurance, there's a beneficiary to the life insurance, but the will would take, this is this probate thing, non-probatable assets out of the mix, and you have to go to whatever county or city you live in and file the will. And then the term probate means that there's going to be a governmental oversight, if you will, to make sure that the beneficiaries are treated as the way that you wanted them to be treated. So in a will, you're going to say, okay, my XYZ thing goes to my brother or sister or my friend, and this thing goes to that. And as you start accumulating stuff, I mean, you can't say the couch goes to this person. The couch might not be there in 20 years, although the will should be changed more often than every 20 years. But it's an orderly distribution of where you want your assets to go. And in fact, some of this might be a surprise to some people because you want to take care of them because maybe they took care of you earlier on in life. And the will is the perfect way then to say, after I don't need it anymore, then I would like to recognize this person to receive it. Now, when should one do it? I'd say once you start accumulating some money and whatever investment it might be, whether it's a TSP or whether it's an IRA, because the beneficiary, that's going to transfer outside of the will, but whatever else you might have, might be a car. Of course, if you buy a car, it's not going to be worth more than a loan after a couple years, but you might start accumulating stuff. You know, it might be a picture. It might be a sports memorabilia thing. But if there's no indication where it's going to go, then it goes in order of legal priority. Right. But you might not want that. And so I would say do it as soon as you start to acquire things, and things might include life insurance.
That That makes perfect sense to me. Now, there are lots of how-to things. I mean, there are books out there, you know, drawing up wills for complete idiots, or, you know, an idiot's guide to will creation. I mean, obviously you get what you pay for or what you don't pay for. How do you feel about doing a will on one's own or actually investing in personal expertise and a professional to help you do this?
Actually, to be totally frank with you, I did it myself.
Uh-huh.
Huge mistake, but I did it. I knew I needed one, but I didn't want to spend the money. So I did it myself, and I got a book, you know, Idiot's Guide to Will Preparation. And the web wasn't what it is now back then. So I was able to put together something. I don't know that it would have been the greatest, but late mid-career, heading home, then I got more serious about it. And also the idea of one's passing becomes a little bit more focused as you get older. So I go, okay, I want this to go here and that to go here. And then you get in. Then it's really hard, and you almost need somebody to guide you through it because, well, you know, how do I take Bob different than Sally versus Sue versus, you know, if you're married, of course, you want to take care of them first. And so I would, if for no other reason, then as you've acquired things, you want to understand where they're going to go, and you want to understand how you might impact people. And some, you know, few attorneys that I've worked with, you know, they'll explain, well, you might have some trepidation about hurting one's feelings by giving the gold widget to somebody else and the silver widget to another one. And you just have to say, where do I want it to go?
Makes sense.
And they can be like shrinks. You know, I would like to say sometimes I'm a money shrink, and I'm sure the attorneys, they're not going to say it, but they're legal shrinks.
I guess I'm a benefit shrink.
Well, you are. And you know, you say, okay, here's the good, bad, and here's what we ought to do. I didn't know I could do that. Well, you ought to do this. Well, I don't know. And then you help them understand. So we're mid-career now.
Well, actually, what I was thinking about, we are mid-career, but I wanted to, if I can just digress for a second.
Sure.
You were talking about something that really hit home to me. You were talking about, I guess there was a lot of inflation, lack of job opportunity when we were first starting out. I came across an article, and I know he's listening today because he told me he was going to listen, Mike Causey, with respect to the cost of living adjustment for retirees, which I guess in 1967 was finally linked to the Social Security COLA. Back in those years, all of a sudden, inflation really took off. Federal pay, interestingly enough, between 1970 and 1975, the top-end pay was $36,000 a year, and that meant that if you were an executive, back then they didn't have SES. They had super grades, 16s, 17s, 18s, even some 15s were all capped at $36,000 a year. Interestingly enough, my first federal job with the IRS, I was in the employee relations office, and I was doing retirement calculations. And I was watching people go out the door at fairly high rates of pay for those days with I guess you'd say 80%, you know, 80 percenters are people in CSRS who worked roughly 42 years or more, and they added sick leave to service, and they were leaving with annuities of around $28,000, $29,000, which was pretty close to the federal pay. And then 4 or 5 years later, because interesting, and Mike's article talks about this, he wrote an article in 1974 about how retiree pensions rise nearly 50% over that period of time. They were actually outpacing federal pay raises. So I got a call from one guy who said, you know, I'm now making more than the $36,000 as a retiree, and he was, because the raises over those next 5 years as a retiree helped him get beyond that $36,000 pay cap, which didn't apply to retirees, only applied to employees. I guess what I'm getting at is we have a lot of people now, and we're sort of moving beyond mid-career, moving toward the latter part of a career, who have been facing the federal pay freeze for the past 3 years, who may have just simply topped out because they've reached the top of their grade or pay band or whatever their compensation program offers. And they're saying, you know, is this a reason to retire? You know, my benefit's not going up. And I, of course, tell them that, well, you continue to work. If you like what you're doing, you're getting your federal pay. You get the benefit of what they call premium conversion for life, health insurance. You continue to contribute to life insurance at the same amount. It's worth a lot. There are a lot of reasons to stay around, but then there are a lot of reasons to retire. But what are your feelings about people as they typically run into this inflationary barrier, or I should say pay cap barrier? What do you think would be a strategy? Is it a reason in and of itself to throw in the towel and retire, or are there other things that you might counsel them about with respect to thinking about making that next step? It's not for my money. It's not just money.
Well, actually, I think as we do these more as we age, I'm finding the people are sharper than they were 20 years ago with regards to this, especially in today's world. Somebody will come up and say, I just don't like working anymore. They may or may not like their job. They just don't want to work anymore. What do you think? And I go, well, do you have your bases covered? Well, not all of them. So I'm told, this is the person told, I'm told that if I stay on the job for every year, like you say, Bob, I get a greater annuity. And we're probably talking about FERS, people that are going to be listening to this show more than CSRS, or not necessarily, but they're going to make more and they'll be able to save more because they're putting money away into the thrift and their compensation. I mean, it's not much, but they got 1%. It's better than what they got the prior 3 years. And somebody would say, well, if I retired, I get Social Security and I get 1.5%, or I'd get a Coca-Cola on my annuity. But it'll never be equal to what you gave up in compensation. Mm-hmm. Never. So they put some more time in, but they're smart enough to know that. I think years ago, somebody dangled a buyout in front of them, and it was $25,000. It was $25,000 pre-tax. After tax, you're lucky to get 16. I'm not saying 16 isn't, you know, a nice chunk of money, but it's you're really being paid to give up future benefits. Why else would they do that? Think about why they're doing it. They want you off the rolls. I don't mean to sound cold, but that's a finance thing. The less salary paid, they can afford to front load that with a buyout. So I just find them more inquisitive. They're still not crazy about working additional years, but they're not necessarily rejecting it.
Well, and I think, too, planning also means knowing what you're going to be doing. I mean, the more you can cost out and understand what your ultimate retirement lifestyle is going to be, I think the more clearly you can map your income to that level of living. I mean, there, as you know, there are a lot of things that federal employees pay or have pulled out of their pay that retirees do not. They don't pay the payroll tax. They don't pay into retirement funds. They don't pay into TSP. They could move to a state that doesn't tax anything, or they may be in a state that doesn't tax Social Security or defined benefits from the government, a pension. So all of these things have an impact on take-home pay, not to mention the fact if you've got a good, solid, three-legged stool as a FERS employee, meaning that you've, as you said very, very appropriately at the beginning, that the more you contribute in full measure to TSP and get it to a level that's, you know, a nest egg that you can draw down. I mean, that third leg is so critical to a solid FERS retirement. It really can make the difference. It can bring them at par or beyond what CSRS people get. CSRS people have a very large annuity. They paid dearly for it. I know this. I mean, we paid 7% of our income throughout our careers. The initial FERS population was paying less than 1% in most situations. There's some jobs that were paying more. And now, of course, the newer FERS revised annuity employees are paying considerably more for this benefit, 3.2%. But it's still, you wind up getting three tiers of income. And the more robust your TSP is, the more likely it is that you're going to be able to make it in retirement. I really think that understanding what you're retiring to, as important to understanding and wanting to retire to something as opposed to from something and just having money, I think is critical. I always advise that.
Yeah, and the other late mid-career, early pre-retirement, we want to be looking at these things as well as things that maybe we didn't look at earlier, like long-term care. Again, I got to be frank. I sat here for a number of years listening to the long-term care folks when they came on the show, and I go, I don't need that. And then one day, I do need that. Now, I was right almost a little too late with it premium-wise, so somebody's got to catch this mid, late mid, but definitely early pre-retirement. Long-term care is pretty important, I think, as well as they need to understand the dynamics of the money. I'm going to retire. Well, how are you going to afford to retire and do projections? How much do I need? I always get this question. I'm sure you do, too. How much do I need to live on? Well, that ought to be the first focus, not the last.
Absolutely.
You know, people look at benefits, and trust me, benefits are really, really important. But unless you understand where the benefits are going, you might retire before you have enough money to pay your bills.
That's so true. And The questions I get are, does it pay to stick around? You know, my high three is going to go up. I'm going to get, a bigger benefit. And then it's a question of what you just said. Well, how much are you going to need to live on? That's always the issue. Sticking around and watching your benefits go up, I mean, whereas that's a wonderful thing to watch. If you have something that's compelling and you're eligible, if you're in what we call the club, if you're eligible to leave and your annuity can start the next day, and that means all of your benefits are portable, and health insurance and life insurance and dental and vision coverage, those can all flow with you in a retirement package. If you're there and you're ready to go to something else, then sticking around to watch that benefit go up by small amounts is probably not the best advice. It's, again, if you're ready to go. And conversely, if you're not ready to go, but you're in the catbird seat because you know you can, then you want to take a little bit more time to think about it. The government is perhaps going to give some of us an opportunity to do that through this phased retirement program, which is about to be launched, gives people a chance to be half retired and so on. But the real key is, are you ready? And how well have you costed out what it is you're going to be doing in retirement? Are you going to be doing something that, if it doesn't add value to others, are you going to feel valuable? Are you going to feel good about it? And do you have enough money to maintain that lifestyle? That's the primary thing that people should be thinking about, as opposed to just simply sticking around and having that benefit go up by a year or two, which in and of itself is nice to look at, but may not be a goal in and of itself.
Yeah, there's a program called the Ballpark Estimator, and it's funded by, it's a big financial house, and they're not trying to sell your product. And it just asks you questions. How much have you put aside in retirement funds? How much have you put aside in other funds? How old are you? When do you look to retire? What percentage of your income do you want to replace? And this is kind of key. Unless you know what your expenses are, it can't answer that question. And they have one specifically for federal employees. So there's a ballpark estimator for non-feds, and there's a ballpark estimator for feds. Why? Because the feds have this kind of unique situation with regards to a defined benefit plan that you talked about earlier. And they have these opportunities to say, okay, what are you going to make once you retire? What's your rate of return going to be? People sometimes mistakenly say, now I'm going to pull way back and we're going to put everything in the G fund because I can't afford to lose anything. Well, you can't afford not to not make anything either. So, if the G fund's going to keep pace with or better than inflation, and you know that for certain, okay, maybe. But nobody knows that. But the ballpark estimator would help you, and it won't take forever to do it. And you can just Google ballpark estimate, and out it'll pop, and then go to the right one.
Let me comment on this. I know we're getting close to the end, but, you're talking about the G fund. If I'm getting the 5% government match as a FERS employee, and I am being conservative, and I have money in G, is that, say, over the last 10 years, would that have kept me at pace with inflation? Have you ever done any calculating about that?
It may have kept pace with inflation with the rate of return. Notice I said may. The G fund, even in the lowest rates of interest, were better than what you could get elsewhere and probably higher than inflation. But if you're investing, you need to invest not only to keep pace with inflation, but to beat inflation, because there are going to be days when you're no longer working and putting the money in. And if the market takes a little bit of a tumble. Now, of course, if you're in the G fund, the market tumbling isn't going to mean that much to you. So you need to spread out your risk. And that's, I think, why they develop the, quote, L funds to parallel one's stage of life. And the money is reallocated as to where you sit. As you age, more goes to the cautious sides, the G fund, and maybe to the extent the F fund, although the F fund can be pretty volatile, as we saw last year. And believe it, lost money. Why? Because rates of return went up and interest rates went up a little bit. A little change in the interest rates will cause a real knee-jerk reaction with regards to bonds, even federally insured bonds. Now, if you keep it long enough, you'll get your money back. But in the interim, you won't be able to sell it for what you paid for it. So that's what happened to the F fund, which has a large percentage of its investment in federal bonds.
So life cycle funds, in your opinion, based on what I heard you just say, are a pretty good idea. I mean, they're all part of the TSP package, and TSP keeps it simple. They keep it cheap. They don't charge you much to manage your assets, less than 1/3 of 1%. But life cycle funds are, I always refer to them as an android or robot money manager, designed by financial professionals. They rebalance on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis, take into account market history. I mean, I think it's better than taking shots in the dark, but, you know, as a professional, what's your opinion?
Actually, if I should be in the 2030 fund, I'd probably want to go into the 2040 fund because it gets a little too cautious too soon. Now, if I'm extremely cautious, I'll eat my words. And I'm not saying the G funds are good, but if somebody is very financially literate, they might be able to do better on their own. They might.
And you also need to think, too, I guess, if I'm a FERS employee and I'm retiring at minimum retirement age of 56 or 57, technically, I mean, I may not use that TSP money for another 14 or 15 years. And even when I do, the required minimum distribution amount is, you know, less than 4% for the first several years. So I could be looking at, you know, a what they call a time horizon, drawing money down as income 15 plus years away. So being too conservatively invested, as you just mentioned, you know, is probably not the best way to go, particularly if you want to, as you say, beat inflation.
Well, you really hit something, because now we're in the latter stages of the career. Again, if we're talking to FERS folks, CSRSers, this is really not an issue unless they qualify for Social Security. The longer you can put Social Security off, and I know you and I could do some arm wrestling with this, the more you're going to get at 70. So somebody would say, well, where's the money going to come from? Well, if we're not going to touch Social Security, I'm not saying you shouldn't, then it's got to come out of the thrift. And if it comes out of the thrift, maybe initially that's what you do to make up for the lack of the Social Security. And then when Social Security kicks in, you can leave the thrift sit. But like you say, if you hit the mandatory distribution, a small percentage has to come out, and hopefully we're making more than what comes out. Or there needs to be some balance there somewhere. And I think that's what you've been preaching to me ever since we both turned 66.
It's pretty amazing. We're both the same age. Well, you know, and it's true. I suggest to people, you know, as it concerns Social Security, if you can draw it without it being in any way penalized because of other work income, and that means you have to wait till your full retirement age, then that's something you might want to do. And it has to do with something that you and I have talked about on a couple of other shows, break-even periods. I mean, technically, if you wait beyond your full retirement age, where you could get your benefit without any reduction for other work income, if you wait until 70, you do get the benefit of these extra 8% boosts for each year that you wait, delayed retirement credits. But then you have to live, you know, into your early 80s roughly to break even. Break even meaning that, you know, okay, at this point I will now have gotten what I would have gotten had I started my benefit at 66. And if I keep on living, I do better this way. So one needs to ask themselves, you know, number one, am I going to live that long in the first place? And then number two, will I be healthy enough? Number three is, would I make better use of the money now when I'm a little bit more vital and in young retirement years, as opposed to, you know, getting into your 80s and 90s where I might still be vital but not quite as mobile. So there's a lot of argument either way for that. What you were talking about is income replacement, and I think that's a good strategy. I mean, you could ramp back the TSP, but if you do start your Social Security later on, then you do have that break-even period to concern yourself with.
Yeah. And I think we have about 2 minutes left, and we purposely didn't open up the phone lines because we had so much information to pour out, and we wanted to walk through each, through three phases. And you have a pretty good, by the way, folks, we did talk about this before we went on air, and Bob generated 10 talking points, and the last one was pretty good. So if you look back at the career, I think you were going to ask me this, and you and I, again, are simpatico here. I've only had two jobs in my life. When I first left school and I went to work for this tax mill, I worked there for about 10 years, and then I joined my good friend Don Gold in an accounting firm. And along the way, I said, gee, I really like this stuff. I'm going to go do retirement seminars to the feds. And I did brown bag seminars for free.
Wow. Yeah. So that's how you got into the business.
That's exactly how I did it. And I did it for two reasons. One, I liked it. And two, for those that wanted an accountant or some advice, I got clients. So I enjoyed it. And it also was rewarding with business.
Yeah, it's a great blend. You know, I call somebody with your expertise, Bob, a twofer. You are, you know, a financial tax advisor, and you have the unique federal perspective, which is something that I always advise federal employees to look for in a financial planner. I mean, it's one thing to pick up somebody who understands finance and investment, but it's so much better if they understand the federal benefits arena and the value of that package and some of the nuances that might be associated with investment. Like you say, when you have this unique defined benefit, and it changes the strategies, it changes ballpark estimators, and it should change the individual you look for to gain advice from. I mean, I would go to somebody like you.
Well, listen, you're the same way. You've two jobs effectively, you know, the federal career, and then now you're a consultant, and I know you like what you do, and you've counseled people on the side, too, regarding benefits, so we're both twofers.
Absolutely. And I do like it. That's why I'm going into sub-zero temperatures next week to teach my next seminar.
Well, if you couldn't tell, Bob's in Florida heading towards where?
Heading towards Moline, Indiana, where it's going to be, I think, a high of -3 on Tuesday.
Oh, man.
Oh, Moline, I guess, yeah, it's Chicago, Illinois, not Indiana.
Well, wherever it is, it's cold. All righty. Yep. So Andrew is telling us, will you two guys wind it down because he's going to turn us off. Anyway, Bob, final comments real quickly.
Just learn as much as you can along the way as possible. Always adjust your strategies. Understand that life is a long time. And get the best advice you can. And don't do it on your own. Go to a seminar. Talk to an expert. It's money well spent. It's time definitely
okay.
well worth taking.
I mirror that the same. Talk to you all next week. Thank you, Bob. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.